Welcome to the podcast service of Sydney's FM 103.2, available on the web at fm1032.com.au.
It was one of the most spectacular corporate collapses in years. Energy giant Enron was brought to its knees at the end of December 2001 after billions of dollars in accounting fraud was exposed. And it was exposed partly through Sharon Watkins, who at the time was the Vice President for Corporate Development, and she joins us now from Houston in Texas. Sharon, thanks for joining us on Open House tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What's it been like these past few years to be known as the Enron whistleblower?
Oh, goodness. Well, certainly my life has changed in so many different ways. I had worked two decades in accounting and finance in the corporate world, and in many ways, my chosen field, my career in corporate America is over, and that's been sort of a slow realization in the last 5 years. But I also have a brand new vocation, which is speaking on the lecture circuit on leadership and ethics and integrity in business. And I really can't complain. I do like my new vocation, but it's odd that the label whistleblower is synonymous with troublemaker.
All right. Okay. Well, I'd like to explore that a little bit further in a few moments. Look, tell us about the work culture of Enron when you were working there.
Well, in many respects, Enron was very fun to work for. The company was the seventh largest company in America based off total revenues. It had a young workforce. It was named the most innovative company in America for 7 years in a row by Fortune magazine. The company constantly reinvented itself. It started life as a stodgy natural gas pipeline company and evolved over time to the largest energy trader in the U.S., trading gas and power contracts. It was very exciting. As a young executive there, you really, even before you were executive level, you were given lots of responsibility. And if you had a new business idea, you didn't have to go through too many hoops before you could actually get a budget and some money and start pursuing that idea.
How many years were you with them all up?
Well, I was there 8 years up until the bankruptcy. And I did stay beyond the bankruptcy, but that time almost doesn't count because the company was not really the same and did not really emerge from bankruptcy.
Okay, well, let's talk about the bankruptcy. How did Enron go from a company claiming to have more than $100 billion in revenue in the year 2000 to a bankrupted company with $30 billion debt a year after?
That was the big question. 13 different congressional investigations were launched to see how such a large company could implode into financial ruin so fast. And what I stumbled across, income statement fraud, some special purpose vehicles that were used to mask losses. But unbeknownst to a lot of us, even that worked there, and certainly unbeknownst to shareholders and investors in the company, Enron had a large, large amount of off-balance sheet debt. I don't want to bore your audience with too many numbers, but Enron reported $13 billion of long-term debt on its balance sheet, you know, the last quarterly reporting that it did. When the company went into bankruptcy, they told their creditors in December 2001, our real long-term debt picture is $38 billion. So there was some $25 billion of off-balance sheet debt. That was just far too much. The company was over-leveraged, and that's what did it in so quickly. It was really unbelievable that a company of Enron's size and stature could have that much off-balance sheet debt.
And what alerted you at first to the fact that all was not well?
I had stumbled across some structures called the Raptors, and they were very complex, special-purpose vehicles. 2 to 3 hours to explain their structure is what it would take. But they were on paper only, shell companies set up with no capital, no equity, no debt investors. They were set up with a promise of Enron stock, and then Enron was doing business with these structures. So I was still a CPA, a certified public accountant. I hadn't practiced accounting in over 10 years, but certainly I knew that accounting just doesn't get that creative. You can't you set up shell companies funded with nothing but a promise of your own stock and then start doing business with it.
Yeah. Just explain that phrase creative accounting as well, because it seems to be there's a certain amount of leverage allowed under that phrase. You can be creative in your accounting but not aggressive.
In the States, somewhere along the way, the accounting firms, the public audit firms, lost their power. Firms like Enron would find accounting rules that were used in one industry and apply them to a whole different industry and say, well, the theory or the logic should hold up, when really it didn't. So things that were meant for real estate business or financial transactions in the banking world were instead used for power plants or complicated power contracts, and they really didn't fit.
Okay, hence the phrase creative. Well, this is Open House, and we're speaking with our feature guest tonight, Sharon Watkins, who is the whistleblower, for want of a better phrase, on Enron. We'll be podcasting this via the openhouse.net.au blog site as well. What was going through your mind, Sharon, when you decided to go and confront your boss? At the time, it was CEO Kenneth Lay.
Well, it was the summer of 2001 when I switched positions at Enron and really, literally just stumbled across this fraud. My first reaction, to be honest, was to try to find another job, to get out of there as quickly as I could.
Sure.
I knew it was fraud. I knew it was horrible. And companies don't usually get away with cooking the books. Someone likened it once to a noose that you put around your neck and you're the one that's tightening it every year. Because if you put some fluff in your numbers and the market is expecting you to always have continual earnings growth, well, then the next year you're having to grow on top of the real numbers and on top of the padded numbers.
Hmm.
And then the next year you're having to grow again on top of real and padded numbers. So it becomes harder and harder to make the numbers. And so companies rarely get away with it. And when they do, though, they do so because they come clean. So what happened to me, I first started interviewing. I did not think it would be very fruitful to go to the current CEO, Jeff Skilling, and complain about what I had found. 2 weeks after I found the problems, he quit. He quit his dream job. He had been striving for the CEO position, got it at the start of 2001, and in August 2001, he surprised the market and resigned. Well, that also told me that what I had found really was fraud, and he knew it, and he was just getting out while the getting was good. And so I reacted more knee-jerk that the chairman of the board, Ken Lay, was stepping back in to run the company, and he just didn't realize. He didn't realize what had happened. If I just went and told him, you know, he'd correct things. He'd address it.
Okay. So you go and warn Ken Lay, and what kind of reception did you get?
Well, I've used the analogy of the Titanic before, because in many respects, I did feel like a crew person who found a big hole. So I go to warn the captain, you know, I think there's accounting fraud here, you know, man the lifeboats, see about preserving jobs, business lines, you know, form a crisis management team, address this accounting fraud, you know, address the hole in the ship, so to speak.
Mm.
And instead, what he did was really turn to the executives around him and say, reassure me that we're unsinkable. You know, aren't we paying Arthur Andersen $52 million a year to audit us? Don't we have a clean bill of health from our auditors? But no one go and look to see whether there's a hole in the ship. So it was a real shock. It was a big, big shock to me.
And what happened for your role there, your job too? Did I hear correctly that they tried to usher you out the door in no uncertain terms?
Many employees have taken a stand for truth, and what typically happens is, if you're not just fired outright or discharged for some strange reason, you know, just right off the bat, then, you know, what the company did with me is typical. I was not really given any real responsibilities. I was moved down from an executive office to a cruddy little office with horrible furniture, and people really sort of shunned me or would sort of whisper behind my back, oh, yes, there's you got the feeling that you were a disgruntled employee or something like that. And the jobs that they would offer to me were far below my former positions. So what I think was happening was that the company was trying to make me miserable such that I would quit. It's just that Enron imploded too fast to make that plan of action, you know, come to fruition.
Yeah. And Sharon, it must have been a surreal experience for you when Enron finally did go down, that day when it finally was declared bankrupt.
Things were very surreal in 2001. Of course, we had September 11th. The company, they wrote off the structures I was concerned with in September, which was announced October 16th, 2001. But they really couldn't explain it. They didn't do it appropriately. They couldn't explain it. The market started asking questions. And in 6 short weeks, the company was declaring bankruptcy. But it just kept getting worse and worse. Nearly 5,000 employees were laid off 3 weeks before Christmas with nothing, no severance, no insurance, nothing. And then one of those congressional committees, of the 13 that had been formed to investigate Enron, one of those congressmen found my memos, or at least a staff person, found my memos to Ken Lay in a box of documents and released them to the press. And then my life went crazy. Mm-hmm. That was just a bizarre amount of media attention. That happened January 2002.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is Open House. We're talking to Sharon Watkins, who was one of the key players when it came to the downfall of Enron, certainly exposing all the corruption that was happening behind the scenes. How did you cope with that media focus there? Suddenly your face is on all the papers and you're on the TV. I saw you on the telly just a week ago. Again, just they were playing snippets again from those hearings.
Well, it was certainly trial by fire. It was very difficult, but it was happening so fast that you just almost have to cope. But the day my name came out in the press, the very next morning, I was getting ready to go to work, and my husband came into the bathroom to say, you know, there's camera crews in the front of the house and the back of the house. And I peeked out, you know, window shades and window curtains and was quite surprised, you know, to see big fuzzy microphones and cameras and so forth, and it really unnerved me. And I had I'd been a churchgoer, but I'd really sort of put my Christianity on the shelf, so to speak.
Yeah.
It was there. I was always a believer, but not as active, I guess. But I had been participating in a few more Bible studies with all the stress of what I was going through.
Mm.
And so I picked up my Bible that Tuesday morning. I remember it was a Tuesday morning, January 15th, and read by chance this verse in Hebrews. It's in Hebrews chapter 12, the first 3 verses, and it talks about, with all this great cloud of witnesses, you know, cheering you on up in heaven, keep your eye focused on Jesus and run the race meant for you to run. It was a very encouraging passage.
Very timely.
And so I went to work through the camera crews. The phone was ringing off the hook. And I had a luncheon that day, a group of women called the Professional Women's Fellowship. The woman who was speaking that day got up and opened up with the very same passages of Scripture. And I would say it kind of unnerved me, because I thought, wow, that's odd to get that verse twice in one day. But it also seemed to be saying there's more to come, because at that point in my life, I kind of thought, I've done what I needed to do. I met with Ken Lay. You know, he didn't quite listen to me. The company's now bankrupt. But getting those passages was like, oh, wow, there's more to this race than I would have thought.
Right.
And sure enough, there was, because I had all the congressional testimony and investigations yet to come.
You do wonder if you would have had the same strength if you hadn't had that confirmation, I guess, from Scripture twice on the one day, same passage, on a very timely passage, that is, for sure, saying, keep on going. Here's the path, walk in it.
Yes, it certainly was very strengthening and very confirming that you're on the right path, but you're going to have to focus.
Yeah.
You know, it may not be easy.
Yeah.
You're going to have to focus.
And Sharon, after all of this, after all of the congressional hearings, and now it's, you know, we're 6 years down the track now from when all that began, how is your spiritual life now?
Oh, it is amazing now. So many different things have happened in my life, real miracles. And as I look back on it, I also developed just an amazing passion for reading the Bible. I mean, just really, where I used to read mystery novels or fun fiction, I get just as much enjoyment out of really plucking through and digging deep in the Bible and sort of getting to know God. And I've had incredible miracles happen. You know, I say that my Christianity was on the shelf. When I went to Ken Lay and I thought about the risk to my own job, I thought, well, no, you know, this is doing the right thing. God will protect me in this. And sure enough, I was protected in it. So I think taking that risk to do the right thing, to speak up for what was wrong, I was rewarded. I do feel blessed in so many ways. And I don't mean financially as much as just emotionally and spiritually and the peace and a whole host of things.
Yeah, Sharon, it's so good to hear that. That is such an exciting and encouraging story to hear, because it must be so daunting to actually go to the CEO of such a giant company and actually say, look, I've got the news, and you probably already know about it, but this place is going down and you need to do something about it. I think for a lot of people, well, me included, it would be very, very difficult to know if we'd actually follow through on something like that. Question to you, where do you think you would be today, maybe even where would Enron be today, if you hadn't spoken out?
Well, that is a very good question. If I hadn't spoken out, I think the chief accounting officer and the chief financial officer of Enron would have kept those fraudulent structures going for a year or two more. But I do think that Enron would have probably imploded into bankruptcy anyway. It's just that Jeff Skilling, the CEO, would have probably gotten away with it. And as for me, I would have just been one of the many 5,000 to 6,000 employees that used to work for Enron that was out hunting for a job. You know, I think I'd still be slaving away at a corporate job, working, you know, 50, 60 hours a week, so busy life would be flying by, you know, and I'd barely have time to be in my family's life. Now I do make a living on the lecture circuit. I have a second grader. I have loads of time to be in her life and be very much involved with her. I might as well be like a stay-at-home mom. Yet I still have a professional career. So I do feel I'm very blessed to have been able to leave that 50, 60-hour work week behind.
Yeah, sure. But the question has to be raised, could you ever work as an executive again after the whistleblower tag?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, not that I would want it necessarily, but honestly, CEOs and business leaders want to hear my story. They welcome me at various conferences, but in terms of hiring me, no. And I've had some higher-ups tell me, you know, Sharon, they're not going to hire you because, you know, they might just want to bend the rules one day, and they don't want someone like you around.
Wow. So therein lies the cost of what you did, the cost of actually standing up for the truth and standing up for what is right.
Certainly. And there could have been, you know, a much greater cost. There was the risk that I could have been dumped on the street. When I testified in front of Congress, they showed me a memo where Ken Lay, 2 days after I'd met with him in August, there was a memo from the outside law firm, Vinson & Elkins, back to Enron saying, per your request, here are the potential consequences of discharging employees who raise accounting concerns. So his first action was to see if he could dump me on the street.
And Sharon, is it true that you haven't ruled the option out of being maybe a public servant or going into politics at some stage?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, but I tell you, speaking around the country, plus having loads of time to read papers and listen to programs and so forth, I'm not very optimistic about where our politicians are with lobbying and campaign finance problems. It does seem like special interest groups rule. My real passion is actually adult Christian education.
Fantastic.
I think if more people truly get closer to God, then more people would be doing the right thing. I think there could be more impact in that arena.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, that's very exciting to hear. Okay, final question. And this comes on what I think is a quite ironic piece of stationery that Enron, I believe, once gave out, some post-it notes with a quote from Martin Luther King on them, saying, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." What advice would you give to people who see injustice and illegal practice around them? What advice would you give them to do?
Well, it's another quote along the same thing. It is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's quote that we err not because truth is difficult to see, it is visible at a glance. We err because this is more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at both those quotes together, they say so much. You know, you see truth, and turns out Enron, there were people before me that protested. You know, you protest something unjust. You bring up truth. You confront an oppressor. And what happens? You get the equivalent of a big back of the palm to the forehead. You know, you get smacked down. And you realize, goodness, to keep going down this path is too much risk. It's going to be painful. So you just stay silent. But now look at the Martin Luther King Jr. quote. You don't realize it, but your life started to end the day you decided to stay more comfortable.
Hmm.
You won't know it for 10 years or 20 years or 30, but you'll look back and something in you would have died way back when you decided it was more comfortable to stay silent.
Very poignant. Sharon Watkin, thanks so much for your time. It's been fascinating to hear your story, and I think very encouraging. If not just a little bit scary too, for those of us who maybe see some injustice around us and now have a bit of an added impetus to do something about it. Thanks for joining us on Open House.
Oh, well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's Sharon Watkins with her remarkable story about her role in the collapse of energy giant Enron. We'll podcast this via the openhouse.net.au blog site too.
We hope you enjoyed this FM 103.2 podcast. To listen to more great audio, visit fm1032.com.au.